Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 2nd of March, Super Tuesday results this hour. In case you missed the results, Donald Trump won in Virginia, Georgia, Tennessee, Massachusetts, Alabama, Arkansas, and Vermont. Ted Cruz won Oklahoma and Texas. Marco Rubio won in Minnesota. Hillary Clinton won Massachusetts, Virginia, Texas, Tennessee, Alabama, Arkansas, and Georgia. Bernie Sanders, Colorado, Vermont, Oklahoma, and Minnesota. It's looking like it's going to be a Clinton-Trump November choice, but then again, who knows in this race? We're going to have a lively conversation this hour with two wonderful political analysts. Molly Ball will be with us. Molly was in Palm Beach at Donald Trump's home away from home in Mar-a-Lago, the estate. And she has a wonderful piece that she wrote today in The Atlantic. We'll talk about that. She also did a very insightful piece, February 27, Barack Obama's heir by winning over the black voters who rejected her in 2008. Hillary Clinton may clinch the Democratic nomination and inherit the coalition built by the president who defeated her. And it certainly looks like that's exactly what's happening as we look at the results yesterday. Also with us is Orrin Cass. Orrin is formerly the policy director of Mitt Romney's presidential campaign in 2011 and 2012, and he is now a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. His essays and columns have appeared in many places, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, National Review, and many other places. And Molly is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where she covers U.S. politics. Molly, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, great to be here.
Hi, yeah, wonderful to have you here. And Orrin, thank you so much for being with us. We're going to have fun this hour. Thanks.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks.
Yeah. I want to start with, Molly wrote a piece. I hope you had a chance to see it, Orrin. And I know you've written too, and we'll get to your piece in a moment. But she had a terrific piece on Donald Trump, because I'm still trying to understand him. And she wrote in the piece, people see whatever they want to see in Trump, and then they refuse to see anything else. She reminds us that he has won the moderate, secular, independent votes in New Hampshire, the arch-conservative, devoutly religious Southerners of South Carolina, and the rugged, gun-toting, government-loathing individualists of Nevada. If Trump is stopped now, what will happen to all these people? Are they really all going to vote for someone who got half as many delegates as Trump and got handed the nomination by a convention floor establishment conspiracy? Molly, how do you answer that? You've been covering this campaign, and I thought your piece was really insightful today. What will happen to all those people? And you've talked to many of them.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, I think in every contentious primary, there are always going to be a faction of supporters of one candidate who angrily declare that they're not going to support the other candidate. And then by November, they've been through their grieving process and they've come around. I've certainly spoken to Bernie Sanders supporters who say it'll be really hard for me to support Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. You know, Bernie brought me into politics and I'm not a Democrat, a rank and file voter. And so you do hear that from a lot of Trump supporters. I think what's different is the Trump phenomenon is so big, and it has revealed such an undercurrent of modern politics that had really gone unacknowledged before. And I think the freak out that a lot of Republicans and conservatives are going through is realizing that there was this big swath of sort of working class white resentment that no politician was really speaking to until Trump came along. And Trump has activated these people. And so I quoted, you know, a man that I spoke to in Alabama on Sunday who was saying that, you know, he thinks if Trump gets shanghaied at the convention, he thinks it would ruin the Republican Party. And I said, would that bother you? He said, no, it wouldn't break my heart. There's a lot of people on the right who don't like the Republican Party and sort of rejoice in the fact that Trump is disrupting it so effectively. And particularly if they feel that the nomination's been stolen from him, which was sort of the only hope of the Republican establishment at this point, is to go to a contested convention and try to take it away from him, even though he has the most delegates. Those people are going to be very displeased.
Mm-hmm. Orrin, you, as a close associate of Mitt Romney, write some interesting things about how some of his policies are in the criticism of Romney's policies are the same policies that everybody's embracing now with Donald Trump, which I think is very interesting. You say that we need to look at, and I'm wondering what this is, what is actually different about Trump and what makes those things about him so popular?
Yeah, thanks. You know, I think the interesting thing is, is if you look at the issues that, that folks identify as really being what's so unique about Donald Trump and what's tapping into what Molly described as this white working class anger, they'll say it's things like how he's taken such a tough position on immigration, how he's the only one out there talking about, you know, getting tough with China on trade. And the reality is that if you look back to 2012 and look at Mitt Romney's platform, he actually had a very similar platform of getting tough with China on trade, right up to imposing tariffs on them if they continued their behavior. He actually had a very tough platform on illegal immigration. You remember he's the one who said self-deport.
Right.
And while I think that's not the right message, the actual policy he was talking about is one of enforcing the laws that are on the books that he stood up for all the way through his debates with President Obama in the general election. And so, you know, you can go policy by policy. You can look at tax plans where Governor Romney's was actually much less focused on tax cuts for the rich than Donald Trump's is. You know, you can look at their backgrounds. You can look at all of the other conventionally Republican issues where Donald Trump is far to the left. And it's hard, at least for me, to look at that and say, well, what's different about Donald Trump is that he's really speaking about the issues a certain group of voters care about. I think what's different about Donald Trump is that he's in a sense an entertainer. He's a very unique political candidate, and I think he's attracting a lot of attention, and people get excited about the idea of supporting him. But I don't think that's the same as saying that he is he represents such a unique strain on the actual kind of policy front.
Mm-hmm. And Molly Oren has written, the real difference between Romney here and Trump is that Romney held himself each day to the highest standards of decency and felt keenly the burdens of leadership. Where is decency in this whole race? Have we no sense of decency?
Well, I think that is part of Donald Trump's appeal, is that he smashes all the taboos.
I know.
And Oren is right. It is much more about affect than about a sort of particular line items in a platform. To a certain degree, you hear people say that they like the way Trump is not politically correct, and what that means is that he doesn't care who he offends. He's willing to say things that are wildly offensive, and then he seems to, you know, equivocate. He refuses to condemn the Ku Klux Klan, and you know, he said things about women and about Muslims and about Mexicans and on and on and on. And people have this feeling that they are somehow being silenced by the prevailing culture, that they're walking on eggshells, and that anything they say is going to be offensive to somebody. And so they like that Trump will just say whatever's on his mind, and if people get offended, he just sort of doubles down on it. I think people find that liberating, a certain segment of people who find the current sort of establishment culture alienating.
Mm-hmm. So what's happening, both of you, Oren, why don't you start? What's happening now as a result of his big wins yesterday? The question is still being asked, is there any way to stop him? Obviously, a whole lot of Republicans are worried that others down ticket might lose some of the races if he is at the top of the ticket. What's going on to try and deny him, if anything's going on, the nomination?
Well, you know, I think there are two tracks, really, on the Republican side. One is focused on essentially the strategic question of what is the right approach to stopping him. That is it better to have a lot of people still on the ballot and try to just stop him from getting enough delegates? Is it still worth trying to see consolidation around a single candidate who might actually be able to beat him? And then the other side of it is just trying to figure out what is the right way to attack him. You know, I think for many months, everybody assumed, look, if we just expose his positions, if we explain that he's not conservative,
right,
voters will turn against him. And for all the reasons Molly just talked about, that turned out not to be a very effective message at all. The message I think you're seeing both the other candidates and outside groups turn to that seem more promising is focusing more on the persona, talking about him as a con man, talking about, you know, how he's behaved in his business dealings, how the things he promises people aren't what he then does, and really trying to essentially go with a very direct character attack. And whether that works remains to be seen, but I think the evidence as of yesterday is at least it is more effective than the other approaches people have taken, because it's true that he won a lot of states yesterday, But you know, he did not do as well as I think probably a lot of people were expecting, and he certainly showed a trend line moving against him as opposed to one where he's gathering additional strength.
Molly, can he be stopped?
Well, I can't predict the future, and I think that you see a real division, as Oren was saying, between the different camps. You know, there is also a camp in the Republican Party that feels it's time to get on board. You have Chris Christie and a couple of other sitting Republican governors and some senators and members of Congress endorsing Trump and saying, well, this looks like the winner. You know, Trump saying, I'm unifying the party, I'm expanding the party, I'm bringing new people into the party, getting record turnouts in all these primaries. There's some excitement there. And so you have some Republicans saying, well, let's all get on board and make the best of this situation. At the same time, what was interesting to me about last night was that you had simultaneously the moment that Trump began to look almost inevitable and the moment that the resistance really began in earnest. You had this Never Trump movement breaking out all over Twitter and in opinion columns and all over the Internet and sort of in the Beltway and the conservative movement, of people finally saying, after months of either being in denial or thinking that this somehow wasn't real, everybody all at once sort of coming together. And you know, you have many donors who now want to pour money into this effort, a couple of PACs that are trying to stop him, Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz really going on the offensive for the first time in last week's debate. Oren is right that Trump underperformed last night. He was leading in the polls in 10 of the 11 states and ended up winning only 7 of them. You had Cruz winning 3 states, which is its own type of alarming phenomenon for certain people in the Republican establishment, but still, that those are states that Trump didn't win. Rubio only winning a single state, and I think his showing last night was quite disappointing for people who saw him as the best hope to unify the party. But you did see in places like Virginia the late deciders breaking very strongly for Rubio and against Trump. So what you hear from a lot of people who want to stop Trump is, at least, you know, up to now nobody has even tried. Up to now, either there have been other candidates who saw it in their strategic interest to attack each other rather than attacking Trump, and donors who held off for whatever reason. They feel like at this moment, at the very least, we have to give it our all. We have to try. We have to put everything we have into trying to stop this, because they do see him as someone who would ruin the Republican brand potentially for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if I could jump in,
yes, of course.
2 points. You know, I think one thing that's interesting is not just that Trump lost 4 states; he came incredibly close to losing 3 others. You know, I think he was within 2 or 3 points of losing in Arkansas, in Virginia, and in Vermont. And so, you know, those are additional states where people say, even if, let's say, it were still a Trump-Rubio-Cruz three-way contest, he might very well lose as well. And then you're talking about someone who won 4 of 11 states. And because of the way the delegates are allocated, what that also means is, I believe he only got about 20 more delegates than Ted Cruz is out of 500 or 600 on the night as a whole. So certainly the headline is that Trump won the majority of states. But if you compare it to Super Tuesday's past, I think it's probably the worst showing we've seen for the person you'd certainly say is the front runner. And then the one other thing I think it's interesting is that Molly mentioned kind of the group of Republicans that are saying, let's get on board. I think it remains pretty striking how small that group is. You know, Chris Christie obviously did and has immediately become a
brutally
mocked
punchline.
You know, I will give anyone any odds they want that the Saturday Night Live cold open this week is going to be his internal monologue standing behind Donald Trump last night. And, you know, sure, Trump could go on to win the election and be a wildly popular president, but most people think this has sort of been a dead end for Christie. He's gotten almost no other endorsement from prominent sitting Republicans, and a lot of people actually think that Rick Scott of Florida was planning to endorse him last night and backed out at the last minute, which is rumor rather than fact, but I think more points in the in the degree to which there is not a significant group saying, some people may think he's inevitable, but I don't really see a group saying, hey, guys, let's get on board. Unifying the party behind Donald Trump is the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are two other sitting governors. You have Paula Page in Maine. You have Jan Brewer in Arizona. Well, I guess she's a former governor.
Right.
And then you've got several members of Congress. You've got Jeff Sessions, the senator from Alabama. So I take your point. I think any other Republican candidate who had won as many states as Trump has at this point would see a much larger bandwagon effect. But it is true that there is a group of Republicans and that are getting on board.
And Christy, you were in the room. I loved your description of him because there seemed to be something really off with him last night. He didn't have his usual bluster and excitement about things. You described it as it looked as though he was being held hostage.
It was really remarkable. He was standing behind Trump all the time. And we saw, you know, a few days ago after he endorsed Trump and, you know, he came out and he gave a speech for Trump, and then Trump sort of pushed him off the stage and said, get back on the plane, go home. So it's been this remarkable, seemingly humiliating thing for Christie, and he's sort of determined to ride it out, but he does not look happy about it. The union leader in New Hampshire that had endorsed him rescinded that endorsement, said, boy, were we wrong about him, and you have a bunch of newspapers in New Jersey saying he should actually resign because of this. So I don't think Chris Christie anticipated the blowback that he's getting for this endorsement.
We'll look at the Democratic side in just a moment, and the huge turnout among minority voters going for Hillary Clinton, huge, huge. Molly wrote an interesting piece about this in South Carolina, in which she said Bernie Sanders was trying mightily to win that state, but it just hasn't worked. As a result, this state and the black vote may prove as fatal to his candidacy as they did to Clinton's in 2008. That certainly appeared to be true last night in the Democratic primary, so we'll switch to that side. But I don't want to keep you out of the conversation any longer, so let me give you our phone number, and we'll be with your calls and your thoughts about what happened on Super Tuesday. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. We have two guests this hour. Orrin Cass is former policy director of Mitt Romney's presidential campaign. He's currently a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Molly Ball, staff writer for The Atlantic, covers national politics, and she was in Florida with Donald Trump at that estate. An incredible room last night, wasn't it? Yeah, that was staged. That was entertainment. And she wrote about that today, and we're welcoming your phone calls. We have tons of them. So we'll get to the Democratic side momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, phone calls, Super Tuesday results, 800-486-8655 is our number. Pat in Richland, our first caller for you. Hi, Pat.
Hey, good afternoon, and another great show, Kathleen.
Thanks, Pat.
Hey, you know, I listen to quite a bit of right-wing radio, Rush Limbaugh and those guys.
Mm-hmm.
And they are really about hate. They're always hating on somebody. They're always telling their audience that the progressives, the liberals, the Democrats are indeed the enemy. Barack Obama is out to destroy the United States. I mean, there is really, we've been listening to this now for like 30 years. And I don't know if your guests know what the Fairness Doctrine was, but
I'm sure they do.
Yeah, when Reagan removed that was like one of the first things they'd done to get rid of the Fairness Doctrine. And of course, when that happened, that made this hate radio, which is wall-to-wall 24/7, possible. Now, in retrospect, Kathleen, does it appear that the folks who installed the Fairness Doctrine were trying to avoid just this sort of hate thing and give the rise to a guy like Donald Trump? And it does get a little unsettling when you think how the country is becoming so awash in guns. And now this hate divisive stuff. What is the end game here?
Orrin, why don't you start?
Well, you know, I think certainly the rhetoric on some right-wing radio shows and also their direct support for Donald Trump is an important element of his success. I do think it's a mistake to kind of try to play the game of picking whatever it is we don't like and saying that's the reason for Donald Trump. And, you know, one of the problems with that is, as Molly described, what you're talking about is a set of voters who in many respects feel like they're the ones who are being ignored and left out and their voices silenced. So the idea that if only we had kind of further cut off their avenues to be involved in the political process or to have their grievances addressed, that they would just go away or not vote or fall in line behind Hillary Clinton, I don't think that's right. So, certainly I think there's plenty of work to be done to think about both the Republican Party and the country as a whole. How did we get to where we are, and what do we want to do going forward? But I think it's a mistake to say, you know, if only we didn't have sort of people calling Democrats the enemy, we wouldn't have Donald Trump. Because, of course, you also have just as many people calling Republicans the enemy, including Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, I would say a couple things about that. I would say what I hear more from the sort of governing class of Republicans is that they resent the talk radio hosts more for stoking the anti-establishment fervor against the Republican Party. You have a very vocal segment of the right wing, and we saw this with the rise of the Tea Party as well, that has been telling people in no uncertain terms that it's Republicans that are the enemy and that they have to throw out the incumbent Republicans, that everybody, once they get to Washington, turns into a Republican in name only, a rhino, and they've got to be thrown out, and we've got to have these insurgents instead. And so people feel like they can't govern once they get to Washington or to the State House, because any kind of attempt at compromise will just be used against them. And it's also been very interesting for me to see the divisions within the talk radio world, because on the one hand, you do have people like Rush Limbaugh and Mark Levin and Laura Ingraham who have been cheerleaders for Trump in a lot of ways, in a way that bothers the more ideologically conservative segments of the party. But you have other talk radio hosts, people like Charlie Sykes in Wisconsin and Eric Erickson in Georgia, who have never liked Donald Trump and have been very disquieted by seeing their fellow radio hosts not campaign against Trump in the way that they have.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Pat, for your call. Let's, before we go back to phone calls, switch to the Democratic side. I think that your South Carolina piece, Molly, was spot on, and we're certainly seeing this play out in what happened yesterday. You were there right before the South Carolina primary and after it, where she won huge with minority voters, and she continues to. You write that there's a pervasive sense any bad blood with the Clintons was firmly in the past. Hillary Clinton is seen as someone who understands the struggles of African Americans, and it really is a sign that it would be very, very hard for Bernie Sanders to win this race because he simply is not getting that vote.
Yeah, well, we really saw this play out last night. You saw Hillary Clinton won all of the southern states that have sizable African American populations. She won Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Tennessee, Virginia, and, in most cases, at least 2-1 over Bernie Sanders, because of the African-American vote. This has been a real surprise to the Bernie Sanders campaign. You know, once they won New Hampshire by such a decisive margin, now that's a state with very few black voters, but they really thought that would create some momentum that they could take to South Carolina, and that once these African-American voters got to know Bernie Sanders, they would come his way because they would be seeking a sort of more radical, more progressive alternative, just as they were in 2008 when they were initially on board with Hillary Clinton and ended up abandoning her for Barack Obama. Now, there's a big difference between Barack Obama and Bernie Sanders. Barack Obama is African American, but it's more than that. You know, in talking to these African American voters, what I found was that they are not necessarily looking for a radical liberal candidate. They want someone who will continue the status quo in a lot of ways. They love Barack Obama. They feel very loyal to him, and they feel that Hillary Clinton is the one who was a part of his administration and is going to continue the progress that they feel that he's made. So someone who is more of a change candidate doesn't appeal to them in quite the same way. Mm-hmm. I think the bigger picture is that particularly in the era of our first black president, but really for the Democratic Party for a long time, you cannot be a credible nominee for this party if you do not appeal to the minority vote. It just doesn't make sense for a party that relies more and more on minority voters as part of the national coalition. And so this has really deprived Bernie Sanders of sort of crucial credibility for his campaign, and I don't see how he recovers from
it. Orrin, why do you think he hasn't caught on in the African-American community, or Latino community for that matter?
Well, I'm probably not the best person to explain the psyche of the Democratic primary voter. You know, I have watched with great interest on the Democratic side because for all the problems that the Republican Party has had with this enormous field who was running, you know, the Democrats have had an almost opposite problem, which is that they've really only had two candidates. You have Hillary Clinton and you have someone who's not actually a member of the Democratic Party in Bernie Sanders. And so I think there as well you've seen some kind of very interesting results. I mean, Bernie Sanders has received a bigger share of the vote in the Democratic Party than Donald Trump has received in the Republican Party. But obviously the dynamics in the two primaries are very different. And I think Hillary Clinton, as you know, as Molly described her, kind of running as President Obama's heir and really embracing him, has positioned herself as the candidate of the Obama coalition, whereas Bernie Sanders has made no secret of the fact that he doesn't necessarily agree with Barack Obama's approach to a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. We heard so much, and I remember doing so many shows analyzing the loss, Mitt Romney's loss in 2012, and part of the reason was that he needed more Latino voters, that the Republican Party had to reach out particularly to that segment. And you hear now that Republicans can't possibly win unless they get a certain percentage of Latino vote, which they don't seem likely to be able to achieve in 2016. What about all of that?
Well, you know, I think those types of analyses are typically pretty overblown. You can run the numbers to show that if you got more of one group, you would do better. That's obviously true, but you can also win by getting more of a different group, whether that's doing better among whites or some other ethnicity. And if you look at the head-to-head polling matchups, certainly Donald Trump does very poorly, but Ted Cruz, I believe, polls more or less even with Hillary Clinton, and Marco Rubio and John Kasich both poll significantly ahead of her. Obviously, those only have so much predictive power. Well, I would say they have no predictive power this far out. But in terms of defining what a coalition could look like, I think it shows you that even at this moment, with Donald Trump doing what he's done to the GOP brand, there's still a very clear path forward for a more mainstream Republican candidate, especially if the person they get to run against is Hillary Clinton.
Mm. What do you think, Molly?
Yeah, I think on the one hand, you know, Orrin is certainly right that we can't know now based on head-to-head polls what the election in November is going to look like. And the case that Trump is making is that he is mobilizing a segment of the electorate that has lain dormant, a largely white, sort of downtrodden set of voters who are going to be motivated in a way that they haven't before. He also claims he's going to win over minorities somewhat magically. And I think what you hear from the Republicans who are opposed to Trump is that what they fear is that he will actually mobilize people of color in particular against him, in a way that will make it much, much harder for them to win any national election. The inevitable fact that you run up against is that, you know, yes, you cannot, you know, count your demographic chickens before they're hatched in any election. But it is true that with every 4 years that pass, the electorate gets about 2 percentage points
right,
less white.
Mm-hmm.
The country is getting more diverse. And so if you have a candidate who does not appeal to minority voters, with every passing election, it gets harder for you to win. You know, my colleague Ron Brownstein has written about this a lot. The fact that in 2012, Mitt Romney won as much of the white vote as Ronald Reagan won in 1980.
Really?
And still didn't win because there were just that many fewer white people in the electorate.
Interesting.
The electorate.
Yeah. Let's go back to phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. Dave in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi.
Hello, Kathleen, and hello to your guests. Appreciate the program. I'm old enough to remember when Richard Nixon laid out his Southern strategy about the time that the South as a result of civil rights legislation was going from Democratic to Republican. And I'm also old enough to remember Ronald Reagan's dog whistles about the welfare queens and the Cadillacs, and that the government wasn't the solution, that it was the problem. And with that and right-wing radio that's built up over the years, I was kind of amused to hear our Congressman Ryan saying that referring to the Republican Party as the party of Abraham Lincoln. I think Abraham Lincoln wouldn't recognize the Republican Party as it is now, kind of poetic justice in a way that the Republican chickens are all fired up and they're coming home to roost, but they're going to the wrong hen house.
Orrin.
Well, you know, the problem with this idea that Donald Trump is somehow the result of the Southern strategy is that Donald Trump's single best state to date and looking forward at any other polls is Massachusetts. I'm a lifelong resident of Massachusetts. I've lived in its urban, suburban, and rural areas for long periods of time, and there are many interesting things about Massachusetts voters, but I don't think you can explain the Trump phenomenon or any phenomenon within the Republican Party as a function of racism or a Southern strategy if the place where it's manifesting itself most strongly is in Massachusetts.
You don't think he was using some of that Southern strategy, though, Donald Trump, that is, when he disavowed David Duke, but earlier he had said that he knew all about him, and he said he didn't know who he was. I mean, there was something at play there that seemed as though he was employing that strategy. Do you think, Orrin, or not?
Oh, I think he is. I think a lot of the things he's said on race and other ethnic issues, the way he's courted white supremacists on Twitter, I think it's all completely appalling, and I think it's one of the most important reasons I and many other conservatives absolutely refuse to consider supporting him.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's very different from saying that is somehow an explanation of why he's doing so well. I think that's certainly part of his strategy, and there may be places where it's helping him, but I don't think it actually, if you go back to the description Molly was giving of his voters, you know, I don't think you can say, well, he's doing so well because he's playing the white supremacist card, or he's doing so well because this is kind of the trajectory the Republican Party has placed itself on. When you look at who the Republican Party has actually chosen as its leaders, from George W. Bush, John McCain, Mitt Romney, you know, Paul Ryan emerging as the Speaker of the House, there are many valid criticisms of all those people, but intolerance is not one of them.
Mm. Molly, you've mingled in these crowds. What's your take on this?
I think there is an element of white backlash to Trump support, and as Orrin says, it's not all of it. Although, you know, you can't say that there's never been white working class resentment in Massachusetts. You think back to the busing controversies, for example.
Yes.
That's something that's happened there as well. But I think, you know, there is a sense that in forming a sort of identity politics based coalition on the Democratic side, something that the Obama campaigns did very overtly, mobilizing black voters, mobilizing Hispanic voters with identity-based appeals, that there was a sort of inevitable white backlash to that among people who said, now, wait a minute, what about our identity? And when I talk to people, you know, at these Trump rallies in the South, in the Midwest, in the Rust Belt particularly, you hear from a lot of these white working-class voters who have felt disenfranchised, who have felt like it's not fair that, you know, black people get to be proud of who they are, but white people don't. And, you know, there are all kinds of things wrong with that sentiment, but it exists. And there is a sense, I think, that these white voters have been somehow racialized by what they see as the racial politics on the left. And so now they do find appealing a candidate who seems to more or less overtly appeal to white racial sentiment.
Mm, that's very interesting. Thank you so much, Dave, for your call. Ruth in Madison, hi.
Hi. I think that voters on both sides are trying to support the candidate that they don't perceive as already bought and paid for. Because where we may perceive like a rhino or, you know, once we send a Democrat to office, like how Barack Obama was going to put on his comfortable shoes and walk in a labor dispute, whatever, this never happens for us voters. Never happens. But the multinational corporations seem to never be disappointed. They get their TPP, they get their Keystone Pipeline, Keystone XL Pipeline. And so, but it just seems that whoever we elect, it doesn't matter because both sides are already bought and paid for.
All right. Oren, are they?
Well, obviously money plays a role in politics, but I don't think it's right to conclude that the challenges that we have governing the country are a function of the candidates being, you know, bought and paid for. I think, as Molly highlighted, one of the key forces that is really motivated a lot of gridlock in Washington has been a really strong effort by what, for better, you know, maybe not as descriptive as it used to be, but what we called the Tea Party, which was very much a grassroots organization pushing against the kind of big money Republican politicians, and they wanted to go to Washington and stop a lot of this stuff. And when you have more of those folks, you get more gridlock. So I certainly think that it's fair to look at each candidate and ask who's supporting them and what are they likely to pursue as a result. I think it's a mistake to conclude from that if you choose somebody like Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders, you're going to get a better result than if you choose someone who might actually agree with a lot of the things you believe and have a chance of putting some of them into effect.
Hmm.
And yet, but this is a very powerful message, and I think that the caller raises a very good point, which is that, you know, as Oren said, both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are getting a tremendous amount of mileage out of this idea that politicians are bought and paid for, the campaign finance system is broken, the donors and the lobbyists control everything. And, you know, on the Republican side, there's a feeling that these politicians went out and they campaigned on all these sort of populist issues, and then when they got to Washington, what they did was they, you know, reauthorized the Export-Import Bank, and they tried to do tax reform. Those weren't the issues that those, you know, grassroots Tea Party mm-hmm. voters put them into office to accomplish. And so I think that message about campaign finance, you know, and Donald Trump going after Jeb Bush for having the $100 million super PAC and all the lobbyists and donors on his side, and then Bernie Sanders saying the same thing about Hillary Clinton and about her speeches to Goldman Sachs, that is a very powerful message on both sides of the electorate, and I don't think we should discount that.
And it is amazing to me that Sanders is pulling in a huge amount of money from people who are, what is it now? It's up to, it used to be $27 per person. I think it's more than that now. But he's getting a lot of money, and he's campaigning on those kinds of issues, and people are sending him money.
It's a little bit ironic, isn't it, that he's managed to defeat the very campaign finance system he rails against. Somehow, you know, the big money for everyone else is corrupt and terrible, but the big money that Bernie Sanders is raising is evidence of how pure and wonderful he is. Now, I get that it's grassroots individual donors. It's
right.
Not from, you know, PACs, and it's not from lobbyists. But, you know, for people who think that the big money controls the whole system, you could hardly get a better counterexample than the Bernie Sanders campaign, which has managed to take a very powerful message that, you know, according to Sanders, is not one that he had any help from the media in disseminating, and yet it was able to find a megaphone and find a large grassroots donor base.
Right.
And so, you know, if there was a conspiracy of lobbyists and PACs to shut out that kind of message, it failed spectacularly to keep Bernie Sanders from getting traction.
Yeah, but he's not winning.
He's not, but he is raising a tremendous amount of money, and I think he really has sparked a national grassroots movement, and he has created a lot of angst among the Democratic Party establishment, and there is a reckoning coming down the line, maybe not of the magnitude that Republicans are going through, but Democrats are going to have to reckon with the fact that there is a much larger constituency for the quote-unquote political revolution than they ever thought.
Yeah. Thanks, Ruth. Kurt in De Pere. Hi.
Hi there. Thanks for the opportunity.
Sure.
If the Republicans have a contested convention and the establishment tries to, or even succeeds in pulling the nomination away from Trump, you think he might strike out on his own and become an independent and maybe even use that to hold a Republican wing hostage?
Orrin?
I think that's definitely a chance. I think the challenge has become more logistical. The hardest part about running a third-party campaign is actually getting on all the ballots. And the longer you wait, the harder that gets. And so if he actually goes all the way through the convention and then looks up in July or August and decides he wants to run, he's going to have a lot of trouble doing that. You know, that being said, I think certainly for the party, whether Trump emerges as the nominee or he's beaten at the convention, either one of those outcomes would be would produce an enormous splintering effect among Republican voters and certainly make it challenging in November.
Thanks so much for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're doing a Super Tuesday analysis this hour of the program. Molly Ball is with us. Molly is a staff writer for The Atlantic. She covers national politics, wrote a superb piece that looks at what happened with Donald Trump. She was at that, what a scene that was, right? There's a picture in The Atlantic today. We'll put this on our Facebook page. She's a terrific writer, and the piece is The Trump Tipping Point. After a strong Super Tuesday, the Republican frontrunner is more dominant than ever, and his party is at war like never before. She was in Palm Beach last night at Mar-a-Lago. And also joining us, Orrin Kass. Orrin is an interesting voice here today. He's the former policy director of Mitt Romney's presidential campaign in 2011 and 12. He is now a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and his writing has appeared in so many publications, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, etc. More phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stephanie in Madison, our next caller. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Kathleen, and hi to your guests. Oh, great show. Great show. You got me back as a listener. I don't listen to talk radio except for WPR. I think it's really... it's like an echo chamber, and I think it's really contributed to the extreme divisiveness in this country. It's a contributing factor. But that's my point. What I wanted to make about this was I think one reason that Trump is where he's at, and he's just confounding all of the journalists and political pundits, is I think a lot of factions that are, blacks, voting blacks that have supported Republicans have felt like they've been played. I'm thinking like people like evangelicals and other groups. And Trump, I think that they've felt maybe underestimated because Trump is who he is and nobody's really fooled, okay? He's been in our living rooms for years and years and years on The Apprentice. It's almost like, hey, there is probably, I think a lot of people have I don't know if cynicism that's too cliche of a word to use to describe a lot of the voters. I think people are maybe feel like they've been stripped of whatever idealism or, excitement or whatever. And it's like, oh yeah, there's a guy with no BS at all with this guy.
Orrin.
Well, I can see people having that reaction, although I suspect to some extent it's a case like the neuroscientists are discovering, where the brain makes its decision and then comes up with the rationale for it afterward. I think especially if you talk about a group like evangelicals, you know, they were one that carried enormous power within the party, and that were really the voice behind a lot of the social issues that people have historically thought of as the Republican Party, and by the way, that critics of the party have always said is what's wrong with it, right? You know, a few years ago, you would have heard complaints about how the party is feeding this evangelical base and wants to turn the country into a theocracy, and then what comes along and actually causes a rupture is Donald Trump, who's as uninterested and directly destructive to social issues as probably any candidate on either side of the aisle has been in recent memory. And so, to be sure, there's some sort of appeal that is drawing voters to him, but I think in the long term, it's really undermining and doing a lot of damage to a lot of the issues that I think evangelical voters in particular held very sincerely.
You know, I'm wondering, she mentioned The Apprentice. I sometimes feel, Molly, that I don't watch those kinds of shows. So I didn't know a whole lot about Donald Trump other than, you know, he had a lot of money and I knew about his real estate dealings. But this whole thing that he gives to us is, there's such a lack of substance in all of it that it really bothers me. The language, the press conferences that you have to deal with where he doesn't say anything that's particularly thought out, where the event took place last night, all the gold, all the women he's had with, I loved her because she was beautiful, and the hair and the clothes, and I don't know, there's something about all of it that just seems kind of trashy to me.
Well, I think his supporters would hear that as a sort of classist statement, and I think there is a sense that they feel that, like Trump, they are looked down upon by the sort of arbiters of taste. But I also think that there is an element of all this that is just entertaining, for one thing. He's a celebrity, and think how boring and stale and choreographed so much of politics is. Think how often you listen to Hillary Clinton talk and think you're just going to fall asleep because it's the same speech over and over, and it's read from a teleprompter, and you know you could recite it in advance before she gets up to speak, and all the press releases are just these stale talking points. Trump gets up there and he's unpredictable, and you don't know what he's going to say, and he puts out these press releases that are just crazy, or he tweets something that you just never thought you'd hear a politician say. So people like the sort of transgressive nature of it, that he's pushing boundaries.
Yeah, I understand
that. He's doing something interesting. Now, there's a tremendous irony in, you know, this man with that hairdo and the tan and everything, that people say, oh, he's authentic, he's real. You know, I mean,
right, it is ironic.
There's an irony there, but there is a sense that there's something spontaneous and thus authentic about him that you don't get from the sort of conventional politician.
Yeah, I understand that. But Oren, it's why I immerse myself in Abraham Lincoln, because I read what he writes and I read it again, and it's poetic and it's meaningful. And maybe it is elitist of me, but my gosh, give me Abraham Lincoln.
Well, you know, I actually find the kind of elitism argument very interesting, because if you think back over the last 6 or 8 months, when all of the Republican pundits and the other politicians and everyone looking at this race said, this is ridiculous, Trump is going to fade once voters learn about him.
Right.
You know, that's actually the very deeply respectful view of the Republican-based voter, that
mm-hmm,
they actually
mm-hmm.
care about the things they care about. They mean what they say, and they're going to choose their leaders accordingly. And I think, tragically, it's his continued success and the number of people actually pulling the ballot for him that are more than anything leading a lot of people to say, you know, either these people just like the entertainment, they're not paying attention, they don't care. But it's really the success that he's having that's doing the most to support the elitists and to support the idea that that large swaths of the electorate are just not really able to listen to actual issues or even look at the actual credibility of people and make decisions about who the leaders should be.
Yeah. Respond to that, Molly. What do you think about that?
Well, there's the one other aspect of Trump's message that we haven't talked about, and the thing that he emphasized in his press conference in Florida last night, was the idea that he makes deals, he compromises, he
right.
gets things
oh, yes.
done.
Yes.
So there is an ideological vacuum there. There is a sense that he doesn't believe in anything, and this is very distressing to people who've toiled in the trenches of the conservative movement trying to advocate for, you know, conservative policy solutions for a long time, because Trump is much more just about making it work and breaking through the gridlock of Washington, said, you know, Obama's been terrible, not necessarily because he's been left-wing, but because he hasn't worked with Congress and gotten the people in the room to get done all the things that everybody agrees upon. Last night he was talking about tax inversions, and he says everybody agrees that it's terrible that these companies are hiding all of their money overseas and not paying taxes on it. The Republicans agree, the Democrats agree, but they can't get in a room and just solve the problem.
Right,
and
right.
So, in
I'm
a way,
a negotiator.
He's the ultimate sort of moderate
yeah.
Republican, right, because
yeah.
he's the one who's going to get everybody together and get them to, and he says, sure, there are issues that people disagree on, but there's also, and he's right about
yeah.
this, there are issues in Washington
that
both sides agree on, and they still can't get it done because they won't give the other side
yeah.
a win.
Thank you both so much. We're plumb out of time. I could go forever on this. I'll look forward to your writings and to having both of you on the air again. Thank you.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Orrin. Molly Ball, staff writer for The Atlantic. Orrin Kass, former policy director for Mitt Romney's presidential campaign. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the show and Scotty Myers.